En mörk oändlig
ängmark. Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On this week's show, the summer holidays are over, and whether you take platform 9 3/4 or mom's minivan, it's time to go back to school. We have a special show lined up today, along with a special guest who we'll introduce in a little bit. And now, on with the show.
Yes, I see. Good news, everyone.
Hi, everybody. As far as news this week, reading. I just finished an Unwelcome Quest. It's the book that we talked about last week. Why can I never remember the author's name?
Adam Scott Meyer.
Thank you. Yep. As far as what I'm going to read next, I'm not quite sure. There's a fourth book in the series that I'm kind of looking at. What's up?
There's five now.
Oh, there's a fifth one. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I might have to read that one. The next one. The next two, I guess. I also go back to university next week, so it's probably time to start reading my textbooks.
Probably.
I don't know.
Boring.
Not really. I am kind of excited to read Restorative Ecology. That one seems interesting.
Seems nerdy.
Well, have you listened to the show?
A few times, yeah.
That's what we are, Adam. We're nerds.
That's right. That's right. I always forget.
So that's reading. And now to get really nerdy, as far as watching / playing this week. So I'm still quasi recovering from COVID. And this week I spent a lot of time in front of the computer. And I've been playing a game called Crusader Kings 3. Have you played this one yet?
I have not. I looked into getting it while it was on sale. I looked up to see kind of what the difference was between that and Civilization, which is a game that I've played a lot. And from what I could tell, it was basically that it's a lot like Civilization, but more Game of Thronesy. It's all about like political intrigue and different houses vying for power and stuff like that. So it seemed a little bit too complicated.
It's kind of like that. Did you ever play any of the Total War series where you control a country or a dynasty?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not that I remember. There was one that Microsoft did, Age of Empires. I played that, and I've played the Civ series, and that's it.
I would say that it's less about family dynamics and like vying for power and more putting yourself in charge of a family during like different parts of history.
Okay.
And it's a little less turn-based. It's a running clock, which Paradox is very well known for. And you just kind of write your own history. So
interesting.
I think it's worth it. But I play a lot of it. But this week I entered a new campaign playing as a prince in Eastern Europe, or present day Eastern Europe. I think technically the county that I started out in was on the north edge of Ukraine, south edge of, I guess, Belarus, White Russia. And that's not racist, people. White Russia is what the kingdom was called back in the day. My goal is to create take over, conquer the Empire of Russia and beat the Romanovs to it and make my family the Tsars of Russia. So that's kind of the goal.
So you're Vladimir Zelensky? then?
No.
In Eastern Europe fighting Russia.
Because Russia hasn't been developed yet, so I'm working my way up to the princes of Novgorod, which is where the Romanovs came from.
Okay. While
trying to keep my borders secure against the Khazars and the Mongolians, who are starting to come off the steppes. So it's the game starts at 867 CE, and you can play up to up through 1450 something. So it just takes the Middle Ages.
Okay. Yes.
So that's my weird nerdy alternate history watching / playing thing going on right now.
Nice.
And then as far as personal news / local news, we got almost 4 inches of rain in an hour today, which caused a lot of flooding, a lot of flash flooding, all of that. It started while I was at the gym today. So I worked out. I started my workout inside, and then where did I go? Our rec center has this balcony where you can go work out outside, but it's covered. And so I just went outside and was doing push-ups, sit-ups, squats, all of that stuff outside, just listening to the rain pattern. Mm-hmm. It was really kind of fun. Almost primal in a way, you know? Like I felt like I was getting, I don't know,
tapping into the energy from the storm.
Yeah, that's it. Except I'm really sore right now, so may have pushed it too hard. But after that, I went over to my mother's house just to check on things, and her basement had flooded. So I spent all morning pushing water down her drain since she doesn't have a sump pump.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was my morning. That was my day. That was my news.
I'm glad you guys are finally getting some rain. I know you've needed it over there. It's too bad that your mom's basement flooded. But
oh well, it's weird.
Lining, I guess.
I went on Facebook while I was in Europe, and I feel like the monsoon cycle started while we were over in France, and so every day I just turn on Facebook and read some of my friends' posts and go, oh, great thunderstorm last night. We need more of them. Great thunderstorm. I'm going, man, I missed it all. Gosh darn it.
So, the universe was just waiting for you to leave.
Right. So I'm glad I got a little bit. It's actually funny. We woke up today and it was foggy and misty, and it was probably around 60 degrees. And my wife just looked at me and said, wait, did we wake up in Iceland again? So.
If only.
That would be the dream, except that now would be about the time that I was looking at moving back over here, because 3 months of darkness does not sound fun.
Yeah. Well, fun. So for my news, for reading, it's the same thing that I've been reading, which is The Sandman by Neil Gaiman and Failure's Not an Option by Gene Kranz. And I say reading, but I'm listening to both of these on Audible since they're narrated by the author. It's kind of adds an extra layer to it. Still both great books. Nothing really too crazy to talk about. Failure is Not an Option is proving to be a lot more interesting than I thought it would. So I kind of figured it would be something I would be interested in just from like an engineering background. For our listeners, you might recall, this is the guy who was the flight director during the Apollo missions, specifically during Apollo 13. So it's the story of kind of how NASA got off the ground, and kind of had that resurgent in the 60s when President Kennedy was like, we chose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. And, so that whole era. But yeah, really interesting. Definitely would recommend this one.
Nice. Yeah, you mentioned that last week, and I meant to write it down and check it out, and I forgot to, so I just took this handy pen and wrote it down this week.
There you go. For me, haven't really been watching anything specifically. I did mention last week about picking up a Steam Deck, so I've been spending some time with that. Picked up a couple of games, or rather, not picked them up, but a couple of games that I've been playing that I wanted to just make note of. Power Wash Simulator, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is surprisingly entertaining. You just play this guy and you've got your power washing business, and you go pressure wash cars and houses and playgrounds and all that stuff.
I really want to give you a hard time for this, but I have played so many mundane simulators, from lawn mowing simulator to like car mechanic simulator.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make fun of you for it. They're stupidly entertaining.
This one, yeah, this one's, I don't know, it scratches that oddly satisfying itch. Just, you know, you're controlling your little pressure washer and you just watch all the dirt go away. It's great.
Perfect.
So, and then I also, this is an older game, so you might have heard of it. It's called Transistor. It's a kind of like a top-down isometric cyberpunk RPG, and I forget the name of the developer. They have a bunch of others that they've done. I think Hades was their most recent, and it's been a lot of fun just kind of getting back in there. You play this girl named Red, and you're trying to find your way through this cyberpunk world, and it has this really interesting mechanic where when you attack something, you can like temporarily pause time and set up all your attacks in advance, and then it executes them all at once. And then, you know, you have to like run around and dodge while that ability recharges. So it's kind of set up as you're fighting kind of like you're a hacker almost, but metaphorically. So all of your abilities are named different things. Like you have an ability called crash and one called like inject and override and stuff. And the things that you're fighting are called processes. They're like little robots that run around and shoot you. But this one's really fun, really cool art style, very like animated. I don't know if you've heard of this one, but
I haven't. And when we were talking about it, I pulled up screenshots, and I don't even think I've ever seen anybody play it. It looks kind of fun. But
it's a lot of fun. It's really great music, really great like sound design, voice narration, and the art style is just really cool. I actually have a couple of like high-res screen grabs that I rotate through my wallpaper sometimes. So,
okay. Nice.
And I don't want to spend too much time on the others because I've been talking for a while, but also playing through Cyberpunk 2077, started a new
save
file. Yeah, I started playing it a while ago, stopped because of the bugs, picked it back up. Playing through as a nomad. I'm literally like an hour into it. So
they've squashed most of the bugs.
Yeah, I was going to say, so far it plays a lot better than when I got it at launch, but
yeah.
And then the other two, Civ 6, obviously. And so these last couple I got into mostly because I wanted to see how they ran on the Steam Deck. So I've been kind of benchmarking them. So Civ 6 I've been playing, which is a little bit slower just because of all the like the AI processing for the CPU turns and stuff. That still plays really well. And then you'll also be excited about the last one, which is Final Fantasy VII, the remake. I picked that up and I've been playing that. So,
all right. What do you think so far?
Better than I expected. It's like the voice acting is really fun, kind of over the top in some spots. Like at some points I'm just kind of like, I just want to like get on with it. Like you really have to have these little narrated exchanges between the characters every 2 seconds. But
I have to admit, I haven't played the remake. I've only played the original, which had the typing where you could hold down A and make the typing go faster.
Yeah. So this is all, I didn't play the original. Obviously this is actually the first Final Fantasy game I really played, but it's all voice acted, narrated.
As far as the remake, is it still turn-based like the original, or is it their hybrid system that they used?
It's not turn-based at all. It's more of like an action RPG.
Gotcha. I'm missing out on the experience, but
it does give you the option to use what they call classic mode, but even then it's not turn-based. It just, it'll auto, like auto attack and auto block for you.
Okay.
But it's not, not turn-based.
Well, darn.
And the only other thing I have to say about it is Cloud's sword is absolutely ridiculous. I don't know. Like, I know that's kind of like a JRPG thing to have these ridiculous weapons, but his sword is just silly to me. It's like this giant rectangle with a skinny little handle. He just swings around.
Just wait until you get further into the Final Fantasy series and you have the pistol with the sword attached to it.
I saw somebody that like made one of those in real life. So I mean, I'm trying to keep an open mind and, you know, accept that, you know, there's other influences and stuff on that game series and trying to appreciate it for what it is. So, but other, yeah, it's honestly, I like to poke fun at it, but it's been a lot of fun so far.
Oh, amazing story. I haven't played the remake, but story wise, I just remember Final Fantasy VII being just probably the first story that really spoke to me at a different level. So I'm excited to see what you think of it once you get to the end.
Yeah, so far it's really interesting. I don't know how the original was, if this is the same way, but it really drops you right in the action, and you're a mercenary working with this team that's like bombing some reactor for this big corporation that's like poisoning the planet. So you're like this eco-terrorist. So, but it also hints at like, you know, there's obviously some things in Cloud's backstory that are going to be revealed at some point. He's, you know, he has like little flashbacks and stuff whenever he tries to act against the corporation or the government or whatever. So I'm interested to find out what that's all about from his time as a soldier. They had like, if he was brainwashed or something like that. But
okay, it sounds like it follows the original plot relatively well. I was on Reddit when the remake came out, and I remember people being excited about it and then being upset during like the last chapter when the reboot rewrote part of the story so they could drop more DLC at the end.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Because money.
I'll shoot you a link about that funny story. I don't want to take up too much more time. But so then my personal news, just spending a lot of time in the garden. We've been getting cucumbers, zucchinis, tomatoes, more zucchinis than we know what to do with, like most people always do. We've got 6 massive ones sitting on the counter and probably 2 or 3 more that are going to have to be picked this week. So jeez. Planning on making some zucchini bread, taking it to some neighbors. Also transplanted our strawberries into their own bed and set up a drip irrigation for them. So
nice.
They are much happier. They were kind of shocked because the tomatoes had like started to go up over the top of them. And they were pretty well shaded, and then they got transplanted into a box that was in full sun. So some of the leaves got crispy, but the drip irrigation is helping get the water where it needs to be.
Perfect. Nice.
So that's it for news for me. So I think that takes us to the main topic, unless you had anything else.
Before we introduce our lovely guest host, as far as what to do with zucchinis, one thing that I love to do, if you have a zoodler, have you seen or heard of those?
Yeah, we have one.
So a little bit of ghee butter, zoodles, some shrimp, and some parmesan, and just saute it all together, and it's like a... creates almost like a shrimp Alfredo with zoodles.
Nice.
One of my wife and I's favorite go-to quick meals.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do that with some of them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Welcome to cooking talk. Anyway, did you want to introduce our guest host?
Yeah.
This week?
I would love to. So, like we said in the intro, this time of year in most locations around the world, everybody's going back to school. On this podcast, we've talked a little bit about the value of education and just gaining knowledge in general. So, we wanted to take the opportunity to get an educator's perspective on tips and tricks for how to succeed, whether you're a student or a parent of a student in the coming school year. So our guest for tonight is my lovely wife, Chelsea. Just a quick introduction. Received her Associate of Science from Snow College in 2005 and finished her Bachelor of Science in Family Life in 2011 from Brigham Young University. Later, she completed her Master of Science in Early Childhood Education at Wheelock College in Boston in 2016. And most recently, she obtained a math education endorsement from Utah Valley University. She has held multiple teaching positions, is a licensed elementary teacher in two states, and currently teaches third grade at a Title I elementary school outside the Boise, Idaho metro area. So, Chelsea, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Welcome. All right. Your biography. I did not realize that you also went to Snow College.
Yep. I was there for really just 1 year. Okay. But I ended up getting my associates through there.
Nice. Yeah, I just saw that in the show notes and went, oh, wow. I went to Snow for a year. Didn't get my associates.
It was a good school. Since we're talking about education, with higher education, I think it's a good opportunity for people to go to different schools. I've now attended, I think at last count, 7 different universities. Wow. And so having seen so many different universities, jumping into the topic at hand, advice for back to school, with a higher education, it's definitely find the school that fits you. Find what's going to fit your goals and your desires, because every school is so different in what their goals are, what they focus on, what resources they have. And so I just definitely saw that, like, there was things I got at Snow College that I didn't get at Utah Valley or didn't get at BYU and some of the others that I went to as well. So it's definitely worth paying attention to what options there are.
I think that's amazing advice.
Yeah, agreed. I've been to a few universities as well, not 7, but yeah, definitely finding your fit helps. So, not all colleges and not all universities are created equal, even though they have the same majors. They definitely specialize in different things. So it's good advice.
Yeah. I haven't gone to 7 different universities either. I've just gone to 3.
It may have been a little excessive, but it does provide for different experiences and opportunities to just, like Adam was saying, to, you know, they're not all created equal. And I think especially in our modern day and age, college isn't the only career path anymore. And that there's plenty of trade schools and other things out there that provide education in more than just the literal sense.
Mike Rowe, if you're listening, come on our show. No, I'm joking, but yeah, I know he's a huge proponent of that. And honestly, as somebody who did kind of the traditional thing and now sits at a desk all day, I almost think that if I were to do it over, I would probably do it differently. Maybe study a trade or do something more outdoor focused, but
hindsight. I was just sitting here listening to Chelsea's story going, not only are we lucky to have a professional educator talk to us about back to school, we also have a professional student. So I just think that's freaking amazing. Sorry, not to give you.
No, I deserve that one. When I graduated with my bachelor's, I made my own graduation announcement, and I basically made fun of myself on there with the number of classes I had taken, the number of majors I'd had, the number of schools I'd gone to, and credits I'd gotten, and yeah. But it's definitely given me a very wide perspective when it comes to education that not a lot of people have.
Cool.
Which is why we are so lucky to have you. Sorry, I didn't mean to clear my throat into your headphones.
So you've talked a little bit about your experience as a student, but I know for the last quite a while now, obviously, you've got the perspective more of an educator, and that's kind of what you have specialized in as far as what you studied and obviously what you do vocationally now. You have some interesting talking points here that I think would be beneficial to go through. We on this podcast, we don't really have like super structured formats or anything. So let's just have a conversation and we'll kind of go through these bullet points.
Well, when you gave me the topic of back to school and kind of what advice I could give or how to succeed in the coming school year, I thought about what kind of framing it as kind of what I wish parents did more of. What are the things that I think would benefit our students that people don't think about? And one of the first areas that I think of is playing games with your kids. You started the podcast with talking about the different games that you guys play, and that's not to say that it has to be video games, but I think really board games, taking the time to play games with your kids. A lot of the kids these days are lacking in social skills and lacking in understanding what turn taking is. Being able to wait their turn and being able to handle failure if they don't win the game. The number of kids that get upset when they're frustrated because something didn't go their way is really something that they need to be successful in their academic work, to recognize that it's okay to fail as long as you try again.
Okay. So I think for me, at least personally, recovering from failure and how that is useful in an academic environment is kind of self-explanatory. How does like turn-taking and sportsmanship help in school?
A lot of parents think, you know, my kid's the same at home as they are at school. And they forget that at home, you know, they're one of maybe four kids, one of a couple kids at home, and they can free range and go where they want. But when you're in school, a lot of classrooms these days are upwards of 25 kids per classroom. and you have 25 kids sharing one space, being able to know how to take turns and wait your turn is incredibly important. Cause I've seen kids just, you know, for things like clipboards, you know, going and getting their own clipboard, they mob the pile. And, you know, I worry that, you know, one day one of these kids is going to get trampled from each other, just not being patient. And so that's where one of my advices for parents is taking the time to play those games and things helps them learn how to wait their turn.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Some other advantages of playing games is especially for your little kids, is learning how to count things one by one. Like that's where you can practice their counting skills. You know, a lot of people see things like Candyland and Monopoly, and those are really great because it's just practicing being able to match and count objects. But also taking the time to learn how to play strategy games. Most of the career fields these days need people who are critical thinkers and problem solvers. And so playing a game that involves strategy and critical thinking will help build those skills so they can use them in the classroom.
So as far as building these skills, do you have any game recommendations for like young families games that really would help a child excel in the classroom?
The easiest one that I have played, and I mean, this isn't like giving specific, you know, product recommendations, but Tenzi is a really easy one. For those who've never played Tenzi before, it's just 10 dice and you roll the dice and you have to strategize by looking at what you rolled the first time to see, okay, well, which one do I have the most of? So right there, you're using critical thinking because you've got to figure out which one do I have the most of. And then you have to decide, okay, I'm going to keep those and I'm going to roll the rest of them and try and keep getting the same number. And so you have to start thinking through that. And for the great thing is that this game is accessible to all ages. I learned how to play it with adults, and yet my preschoolers and my kindergartners, when I've worked with them, it's given them opportunities to practice recognizing numbers. One of the skills that parents don't think about often is, in educator terms, we call it subitizing, and it's being able to recognize a group of objects as a number. So when we look at a dice, we see the pattern of the dots in the corners with an empty spot in the middle, and we know that's four. Our brains can process that four corners means four dots, and the dot in the middle, that means it's five. You know, we can process that, but little kids have to count the dots. They don't see that as four. They say, 1, 2, 3, 4, and count it one by one. So Tenzi is a really great one to give them practice identifying those numbers, but also being able to get a little bit of that critical thinking.
Awesome. Great recommendation.
Where we moved from, it was a pretty common game. A lot of people knew about it, but as I've been introducing it to my students here in different places, I'm surprised that people haven't heard of it.
The thing that, I mean, this is not one of my favorite games. It gets kind of loud. You know, you've got like five or however many people rolling, you know, 10 dice at the same time or whatever. But I like it because you can buy the official game that has like the book of the different patterns that you try to collect, or you can just get a bunch of dice and decide which patterns you want yourself. And so I know the school you teach at is a Title I school. And so for families that are on a fixed income, that is a great option if it's something they potentially already have the pieces for.
Well, and you don't, if you're playing it on your own, you could just do five dice. You could do, especially when I'm introducing it from an education standpoint, I quite often we'll tell them what number to look for instead of using that critical thinking. I'll say, okay, do you want to look for one or two this time? Just so that they're getting used to that idea of what to look for, so it's not too overwhelming. But the a trick that we use at school when we're playing it, they play on the carpet. We definitely do not play on the desk. It is way too loud.
Magic the Gathering play mats or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Nope. But playing on the floor also helps to put it so that it's quieter. And then most sets of Tenzi that you buy come with 10 dice of different color, like of sets of one color, so that it's easy to know whose dice belong to who. But yeah, that's probably the quickest, easiest example. Just a lot of really just any games that kind of use that strategy and thinking. So not just sticking with the games that are just for kids, like looking in some of the family games and looking at some of those that look for games that have a board movement and have things to keep track of.
Nice. Some notes so we can put this in the show notes for the listeners.
Perfect.
I'm biased. We own quite the collection of board games, so I'm a little biased that way.
Way too many.
But that's one of the things I see is that kids just, they need, one of the things that will help them be more successful at learning is being able to think things through and process things. And games give you that opportunity to build experiences interacting with other people.
I really like what you're saying here. Coming from, so I recently quit a job at a high school. So you're on the elementary end. I was about to go to college end. A lot of the high school curriculum is based off of STEM fields now and science, technology, mathematics. And I feel like what you're saying with trying to get kids young to play these games to help them critically think, help with number recognition, help with turn taking, help with like teamwork, all of that. I feel like that even that is missing with a lot of kids that are coming into the high school right now. So I completely agree. And I just want to mirror games are a great way to get kids involved in like a critical thinking aspect. And I just love that you have a favorite game. You have this easy game. When I was working in special education, we played Bunko, which is another dice game, mm-hmm. For the same reason. So it's just really cool to hear your ideas on that.
There's definitely a lot of dice games out there. Your comments actually made me think of a category of games that not a lot of people are aware of, is cooperative games. And those are cooperative games are a whole genre of board game where rather than competing against each other, you and your teammates are competing against the game. So if your family is one that maybe you guys get too competitive, you may want to try a cooperative board game that lets you work together for a common goal. So some examples of those are Forbidden Island is a cooperative game. You're working together to find the different treasures so that you can escape the island before it sinks. And Pandemic is another one. Yep, there is a pandemic game. Another favorite one is called Flashpoint. That's you're working as a group of firefighters to put out a fire in a house. And so cooperative ones are another way to, again, build that teamwork skill and communication skill.
Nice.
So, which actually kind of segues into another topic of things I wish parents did more of, and that is communication. It's being able to not only encourage your child to talk in complete sentences, if you really pay attention to when kids are talking, a lot of kids are just giving one word, two word answers. We don't really encourage them to repeat back things in a complete sentence. And so finding ways to get them communicating more is really a strategy that can help if you work on that at home with your kids, or even as an adult, paying attention to what you're saying helps you, you know, repeat back to somebody what they've said to you. You obtain more clarity. Which kind of like my number one advice that I give for when parents ask me, okay, well, what can I do at home? What can I practice at home so that I can help my kid? And every grade that I've taught, when I get that question at parent teacher conferences, I have always given the advice of writing in a journal. It's a way to practice those complete sentences, practice being able to explain things, and it gives them a place to practice their spelling and really just authentically write. Because I feel like sometimes when we send home practices or you're actively looking for a practice, that authenticity gets lost.
Any journaling techniques that you recommend? You mentioned just writing in complete sentences and all of that. For the kids that are not in the early K through three, kindergarten through three, or like, I don't remember what the European equivalent is, but for the not young kids, but kind of middling early kids, is there prompts or anything that you would recommend, or any sort of website that gives you journaling prompts?
That's definitely a tough one. There's so many websites out there searching for prompts for kids. Would you rather questions are a great, easy one to help kids get started, because it gives them two choices and it also gets them to frame their opinion. I mean, if you think about the number of people these days, when we're commenting on different posts on social media, a lot of our communication is written these days. And so the more we can get practiced at writing things clearly so that people understand, the hopefully less arguments we will have, or we will have more effective arguments because we'll be able to clearly state what it is that we want. So I don't know that there's necessarily a specific journaling technique. It's hard because I do come from the younger childhood perspective. So some of the things that relate to journaling that I think of when I think about it is it improves their ability to I just lost my train of thought.
That happens.
Yeah. All right. For like kids in second through fifth grade, so elementary age kids, it definitely helps with the being able to use past tense, being able to explain, like, so when you're writing in a journal and you start writing about your day, you're able to practice using those verb tenses. Or if you're writing about, oh, what, I'm really excited for this event coming up, it gives you a place to practice that and to recognize that you've got to use different things for different situations.
So would you, with journaling and writing at home, would you recommend that, like, is it more important just to get the kids writing, or do parents need to be careful about like spell checking things so that the kids aren't ingraining these like poor habits? Mm-hmm. Or if it's both, kind of like, where is that happy medium?
That definitely comes down to where they're at developmentally as an age range. Because I could definitely go on a, off on a soapbox on spelling and telling kids to correct their spelling. And it might be actually opposite of what you'd think.
Well, and I actually, a lot of adults these days I know don't know how to spell either. Like, right. I see it on social media and it drives me nuts.
Yeah. Ultimately, there is a place for correct spelling. I think if you want to have accurate communication, you need to spell things correctly. Like you said, like if you're communicating on social media, if you're using the wrong word, people are going to misunderstand what you're saying. And, but a kid who's learning how to write, it's extremely important for them to be able just to practice writing. And when we tell kids, we get this in their heads that they have to have things spelled correctly, they stop writing because they're so worried that they're going to spell it wrong.
They're afraid of making
mistakes. They're afraid, yeah, that they don't continue writing. And so, I mean, I worked with a kid today that, what was the word that she was writing? I don't remember. It was some word like treat. She was trying to write it and she wanted it to be spelled correctly. And so I helped her kind of sound it out and, she spelled it with EA instead of EE or EE instead of EA, whatever the word was. It was the wrong E pattern. And when we got done sounding it out, she's like, okay, is that correct? And I was like, you read it to me. Can you tell that that's what it says? And so we sounded it out based on what she wrote. And it was the word that she was trying to write. It made the right sounds. And so I was like, if I were to come read your journal, I would, or your story, whatever it was, I would know what you're trying to write. And that to me is more important than making sure that it's exactly written correctly as a child. Encouraging them to just be able to keep writing. Otherwise they get so hung up on one word, mm-hmm. they never finish. And we're stifling their creativity when we do that.
That sounds like a buzzword.
Like I said, I could go off on a soapbox on that, but you know.
I may not be in education, but I recognize buzzwords when I hear them.
No, I like that. I wish someone would have told me that when I was younger. The forced spelling tests and all the BS that I had to do in elementary school. Like, I feel like it squashed my creativity, especially in like creative writing. And I ended up journaling more through drawing and sketches because I was afraid of making these mistakes. So I really like that you as a teacher are trying to get the thought out.
Well, and we're before. Sorry, I totally cut you off.
Oh, no, you're good. I had one word left in my tirade.
So we actually just started school this week, so I'm in the midst of getting to know new students, and so that's why some of these things are kind of popping up, because I'm having to explain these ideas to these kids because they're not used to having a teacher that says that says, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to spell that word. You write it so that I can read it. You write it so you can read it. And but that's what I explained to them today, though, was that same little girl, I explained there's a time and a place. So when we do start our spelling unit, those words, I am going to expect that you spell those correctly because we are learning how to spell them. But when we're just writing other things, I need to you to write it so I can read it. And that's the important thing. So that's where when, you know, if you have a child who gives you something that you can't read and you're just like, I have no idea what these words say. I have no idea what sounds they are. Have them read it to you. You know, oh, well, tell me what this says. You read it to me. And then all of a sudden you can now see and read and understand what they wrote. And you're like, oh, I can see that that's the sound. Like you missed these sounds, but like, I see what you wrote there. And so being able to be encouraging to your children is one of the, another biggest things that you can do for your child is just encouraging what they are doing. That doesn't mean say every single thing is great and amazing, mm-hmm. but you know, making sure that you're recognizing that they are a child and they are learning.
Okay. Yeah, that's all really great information. And yeah, I can definitely remember things being different when I was in school and probably not as good. So I don't want to dwell too much and go, you know, too myopic on some of this, because you have some more excellent talking points here. What about some of the things that go on at home that can be detrimental? Because we've talked a lot about like what kind of things parents can do to help, playing games, encouraging writing in journals. What are some of the things that you see that happen at home that negatively affect school, and what advice do you have there?
So first off is looking at your routines. What are your routines that you do at home? And first and foremost, make sure your child is getting enough sleep, please. we tend to see it a little bit more at the beginning of the year because they've been on their summer schedules and it's that transition, that like summer lag instead of jet lag, like, you know, getting transitioned back into school. But I had a kid fall asleep today in the middle of class, and it's, you know, especially with children, most of them are not doing it because they're bored and they don't want to pay attention. Like, they're doing it because their body is that tired and they fell asleep. And so, you know, as I talk to parents and ask parents, a lot of times parents aren't always wanting to be fully honest because they're afraid of getting in trouble. But, you know, I appreciate the honesty when a parent just tells me, you know, you're right, I don't have a bedtime. I don't, you know, my kid stayed up till 1 o'clock this morning. And like, I would rather know that your child is staying up till 1 o'clock in the morning so I can be a little more patient. But getting them to bed on time at a time that works for your family and your schedule, but helping make sure your child's getting enough sleep will make a big difference in their education.
Yeah. Or even, you know, if it's not going to get them in trouble officially,
right.
making air quotes. I imagine there's a lot of nervousness around how the teacher is going to perceive them as a parent.
Yeah. And that's part of that routines is that, and that knowledge is knowing there's a lot of push in education these days to get to know the students, know who they are. What are, you know, what is their background? Where do they come from? It's not cookie cutter like it was when we were kids. You know, almost every home was a mom and a dad, and mom was home. And so it was very easy for teachers to make generalizations. Okay, make sure mom's the one that gets the information, or make sure dad will lose it, or dad's not involved.
Yeah.
Like mom's the one who takes care of everything because dad's busy working. And so there's a lot of assumptions that teachers could make, and it wasn't a problem. But I mean, over the years, I've been teaching in elementary school level for more than 8 years now. And I have seen so many different living situations, grandparents caring for kids who are their, you know, it's their grandkids, but they told us that, but the kid doesn't know their grandparents. They're just parents to them. They're the only parents they've known. Or, I've seen situations where the parents had passed away and an aunt and an uncle are now the new parents. And so being sensitive to that as a teacher is really important, at least, you know, for me to be sensitive to that. It's not as, I know it's hard for parents to want to share personal things like that, especially when, you know, divorces are not easy things to talk about because it's, you know, traumatic in some way for everyone involved. And so people don't want to rehash it, but it affects your kids. And if you aren't willing to share that with us, we can't help your child. Sorry, a little soapboxy there.
I just want to chime in. I think that's great advice. The more information is shared between the learning team, is great. And I do feel like learning does continue at home. And so to have teacher, parent, teacher, grandparent, teacher, teacher guardian, I guess is the PC way to say it, on the same page and understanding the situation, I think only benefits the student, right?
Right. It's the more information we know, the more we can be patient with a child. You know, when we find out that, I mean, I had one of my students one year who, you know, comes up to me, oh, you know, my mom got arrested last night. Oh, well, no wonder you've been a terror this morning. Like, you know, if your living situation is in crisis, you don't know who you're going home to tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough on the kids, and they see more than we think they see. I found in one of our meetings, they showed us a comic of this kid carrying some baggage. So for those of you who are watching, you can see this comic. Because I feel like it really illustrates one of the problems that we see in modern society. And it shows a little kid carrying some suitcases. And the suitcases are labeled with hunger, sickness, homelessness. And then there's another little kid walking by with just a small little backpack. And they're right over with the teacher already going into class. And then the caption for the picture is, can someone help me with these? I'm late for math class. And so recognizing this idea that some kids come to school with more baggage and they can't meet those needs. They can't learn if they're worried about when are they going to eat again? If they're worried about where am I sleeping tonight? Like, that's not going to be on their concern.
Right. It's kind of like that old, I guess old new thing that came out during the pandemic of, we're not all on the same boat. We're in the same storm, but some of us are in super yachts. Some of us are in little dinghies. Like, we don't know what other people are going through, and we just need to be accepting of everybody and try to figure out how to help out. Not education related, but that's kind of the mental image that I had when mm-hmm. you were talking about that. And the cartoon, I feel like, is very similar with the little child wearing just a regular old rucksack, and then this kid that's bringing the equivalent of his entire life with him to school.
Yeah, I've seen all sorts of different situations over the years. And so just recognize as a parent, chances are we probably have seen something similar. And, you know, not, unfortunately, nobody's perfect. So, you know, not every teacher is going to respond empathetically, but they should. Like, you know, we have to recognize that kids are just, you know, they're more than what we see in class. And one of the best ways you can help your child for school is helping make sure that your teacher knows what your child is dealing with.
Well said.
And I know I kind of alluded to this earlier, but I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you always do. It's one of the reasons I love you, but on those rare occasions, no, I'm just kidding.
Aww.
So my belief and what I've seen, and, you know, granted, I don't know the whole story because you've always been very good at keeping confidentiality. But most teachers are really not going to care what the situation is or how the situation makes the parents look. You're not going to care, you know, what the parents' financial means are, if they have to walk the kid to school because they can't drive. You're not going to care what they do for work, mm-hmm. if they work. Your interest is really going to be the welfare and well-being and the learning of that child. And while I know that definitely is not going to alleviate all of the apprehension that some parents in those situations have, I know, hopefully it helps maybe. So long before you and I met, I worked for DCFS in Utah. That's the Division of Children and Family Services. And I was responsible at that time for being a caretaker for children that had been removed from the home because it was an unsafe situation. And so the police would go, they would remove the children, they'd bring them to me, they'd live with me until they found a foster home. And in some cases, like, we would have to deal with parents or guardians. So say, for example, child gets removed and then like grandma contacts the center saying she wants to take the kid. And really, like, we saw some of the, what most people would consider like the most destitute or quote embarrassing situations. And we honestly did not care. Like, as long as the child was happy and cared for, that was our top priority. We didn't matter where they came from, what the situation was, zero judgment, just, you know. And even in cases where the parent had to voluntarily give up guardianship of their child, again, no judgment at all, just more than anything happy that the parent was willing to do what was in the child's best interest. So, and I know that's more extreme. That's more than what you're going to see at elementary school, obviously. But I feel like that same principle holds true for yourself and for the vast majority of teachers.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you have to remember that we're spending a lot of time with your child. So, you know, the more we can know about your child, the more it can help us. And so the more you're willing to just share that information, the easier that relationship is going to be. And remembering that your child is one of however many kids in the class, the more you can reach out as a parent, the easier it is for us as teachers. I mean, yes, we do end up with some parents who are a little too much and wanting to know every single thing and wanting reports on everything, single thing. But I think there's a difference in doing my best as a parent to share information, not always expecting that I'm going to be getting information, because recognizing that my child, again, is one of however many kids in the class, they can't, you know, it takes time to respond to emails and information, but it's still important to know those things, to know, you know, when there is divorce situations, knowing, you know, how does your child go back and forth between the houses? What is the, you know, is there animosity between the two situations? Is it regular? I've seen a definite spread of situations. I've had families where basically the kids stayed in one house and the parents switched off who was there. And was very much a co-parenting situation. They were working, you know, very closely together to keep track of their kids and were friends, even though they weren't married anymore. And I've seen other situations where there's restraining orders, and we have to be aware of that as educators so that we make sure that we don't send the child home with somebody they're not legally allowed to be with. So it's, you know, it's just really important that you remember as a parent, just share the things that could impact your child. And And that includes like diagnoses your child might have. You know, if you've gotten diagnoses of ADHD or some medical diagnosis of something else, you know, share that. Like, I've had parents hide that their child's on medication for ADHD because they were embarrassed or because they were worried about it. And I'm like, you know, I would have treated your child differently from the beginning of the year in a good way had I known that, because I would have known that it's harder for them to accomplish certain tasks. So being able to be aware of that helps so that the teacher can get them the resources that they need.
Awesome. I know in our situation, we're talking a lot about sharing with the family or with teachers and whatnot. I want to let our listeners know, at least at the high school level, I would assume that it's the same at the elementary level, that there is kind of a confidentiality contract that I used to have to sign every year saying what's shared with me, unless it directly is a danger to the student, would stay between me and the parent, type of thing. And just don't be afraid to share this information, because a teacher is not going to go out to a bar and over drinks talk about little Bobby Sue and how they are on medication and how dare that family. Like, there's no gossip that's going to go on. I think just letting the listeners know that that's what's going on.
Well, and there is that legal expectation for confidentiality. That's why laws like FERPA exist, for, you know, families' educational rights for privacy. And so being able to make sure that, you know, legally we are held accountable to be confidential with that information. So, you know, there are some, you know, as with any profession, there are people that break that and there's consequences for that. And so just knowing that you want to provide the best foundation for your child. So doing what you can to help the person who's caring for your child know what's going on is going to make their education better.
Great, great advice. Anything else that you wanted to add before we go into some hard questions from your interviewers?
You know, just teach your child to be kind, teach your child to hold the doors for people, pick up trash. You know, a lot of times we are, well, it's not my trash, it's not my mess. Well, you know, you're right. It's not your trash. It's not your problem, but it is your city or it is your community or it is your planet. And, you know, what kind of world do we want to live in? And so our goal as educators is to create the next generation of functioning adults. Like, we need, you know, we're trying to prepare these people to be contributing members of society. And that's more than just what they know in their head. And that's what we're seeing a trend of, is more and more behaviors and other things that are getting in the way of us being able to focus on giving them the knowledge. And so doing what you can to, you know, recognize that school is school and home is home can help bring the important parts together and really strive to create a balance and a community between the two things is what's going to help your child the most.
Very awesome. Well said.
Yeah.
I had to step away to take away a dog squeaky toy.
I heard it. It was kind of making me smile. She just wanted to be part of the episode.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that was really great information. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing those thoughts and also taking the time to put it together ahead of time. I know you kind of were apprehensive, but really appreciate your time. Just a couple of questions that we felt would be good, you know, that maybe our listeners would have that you can just go over. So the first one, back to school is this time of year, you know, go to the store and you see, you're going to see banners everywhere. As far as back to school shopping, what is some things that is necessary for your classroom? And what are some things that families can save money on?
So looking at, you know, again, every grade is different. Every school is different as to what they're requiring and what they're expecting people to bring. So definitely, you know, looking at that list and seeing, okay, what is it, you know, that they're asking for? You know, don't be afraid to throw in, you know, if it says four markers and the package comes in eight, you can just send the eight package. Like, we're not going to count. We're not going to go through and count your child's supplies and make sure that they brought exactly what was on the list. Like, you know, generally, you know, that's a minimum. Like, you know, it is frustrating when, you know, we've said like we need three notebooks and we only end up with two. But the reality is when it comes to the finances, just, you know, do what you can. If you can't afford something, you know, let your teacher know that, because a lot of times there are extra supplies. There are, you know, this year working in a school district, it's interesting because, you know, we for consistency, they send out the same list for the whole district. And so the same list goes to everyone, but, you know, I've got stacks and stacks of notebook paper that I don't know if I could even go through all of it in one year, because just over the years, it's just gotten collected and collected. And so you can check with the teacher and see, well, what does that teacher have a lot of that they don't need? Or what are the things that that teacher thinks are the most important for their classroom? Like, you know, scissors is another one that sometimes, you know, classes don't have scissors. And so they really do need each kid to bring their pair of scissors. But other classes, especially teachers who've been teaching for a long time, over the years, I've collected more than, you know, 20 pairs of scissors that have been left from kids in previous years. So I have more than enough for my class, but I, you know, depending on the situation, I can't like broadcast that before I've met your children. And so that's one of the things that I think is hard about back to school supplies is I wish we could hold off until after you've met the teacher so that you can really know, okay, what is it that you need? And unfortunately, I think education has shifted to where a lot of that burden is being put on families. If we were to get on a soapbox, that would, I think, honestly, most back to school supplies, I think schools should just be purchasing those. I think, you know, it's like any business. If you need it to do your job, then the business should be providing it. If we need it for them to do their schoolwork, we should be providing it for them. Because different teachers have different opinions on things. Some people think it's a joke, but yes, the quality of the supplies you buy does make a difference for us. Am I going to think less of you for buying the Rose Art crayons instead of the Crayola crayons? No, I'm not even going to remember which kid bought Rose Art crayons instead of Crayola. But as a teacher in the classroom, there is a difference in the supplies that we get. Crayola crayons, and they don't break as easy. They last longer. The colors are brighter. And the big one is, you know, a lot of teachers request the Ticonderoga, however you say that one, pencil.
Dixon Ticonderoga.
Because they do sharpen better. They work better. They don't break as easy as others. But am I going to really care in the long run which kid brought which supply? No. That's why I think it's more important to pay attention to what fits in your budget and your means and doing what you can.
All right. Next question. Brand new graduate, first year teacher, any advice for them going into this field, especially with, I hate to say it, but all the hate and the pushback that's going on in education right now. Is there anything that you could, that you would tell a first year teacher to hopefully get them to stay with the profession?
You mean my first advice can't be run and find a different career?
If that's your real first advice, then I guess that's it.
I mean, truthfully, right now, with all the politics and everything involved, that typically is my first go-to. Like, when I hear kids, I hear people looking at going into education, I'm like, you know, you really got to make sure this is a career for you, because there's a lot that goes into it. But in reality, if it's a first year teacher, they've already made that decision. I'm not changing that decision for them. They are already the first, you know, first year teacher. The best advice I can give to a first year teacher is balance your life. Recognize that school isn't everything. You need to have a personal life too. Cause it's really easy your first year to get caught up in making everything perfect. Especially in this age of Pinterest and Instagram and TikTok, you know, we see teachers who are veteran teachers who have these Pinterest perfect classrooms. And so there's a lot of like pressure to feel like you have to have your room be this like beautiful oasis as well. And you can't do that your first year. And so as a first year teacher, like, one, don't buy everything your first year. Like, if you are going to spend your own money on stuff, which you shouldn't, but if you're going to spend money on stuff, like, you don't have to buy everything your first year. Like, that's why veteran teachers have as much crap as we do in our classrooms, is because we've gotten so much stuff over the years. You can't do it all your first year, and know that it's not going to be perfect. And so being willing to admit, you know what, I am learning and it's not going to be perfect my first year, but just keep trying.
Awesome.
And find a good friend that you can vent to and talk to at school. But make sure you're finding a friend that's going to help uplift you and not just be pessimistic about everything.
Find a flavor of wine that you really like. Just really quickly with your comment about spending your own money, just in case some first year teachers are listening and don't know this, in the United States, you can claim it's either $200 or $250 on your taxes as a rebate. If you are a teacher and you spend it on school supplies. So, or I guess it's a tax credit, not a rebate. But
yeah.
So. Also, if you're buying something specifically for your classroom, go talk to the treasurer at your school and grab that little tax exempt piece of paper and take it with you.
Yeah.
Because not having to pay sales tax on certain things is awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of receipts over the years that I've had to eat and pay. Like, I might've gotten reimbursed for stuff, but I had to pay the tax because I didn't get it tax free. So
yeah,
that's, again, it depends on the school you're at and what resources your school has, but don't give in to the pressure that you need to spend all your money on your stuff. Like, you have no obligation to spend your own money on your classroom.
So, third of the four questions that we have outlined here, and I know you touched a little bit on this just a minute ago, just talking about how a lot of the country is seems to be very anti-public education. But how do you stay positive when you see that, and, you know, when you have to deal with it? How do you keep that positive mindset, to throw out another buzzword?
First, finding those people who are in that positive mindset. If you're surrounding yourself with teachers who are positive, then you are more likely to stay positive yourself. If you're surrounding yourself with other teachers who hate it, then, you know, then you're going to start to hate it too. And so finding who are the people around you. I know I definitely can be pessimistic at times. There's a lot of challenges right now that education is facing, and we're very quickly heading towards some sort of crisis. And I mean, if it's not already a crisis, but I think just focusing on the small moments is one way to stay positive. And so trying to remind ourselves each day, like, okay, here's, you know, today was rough, but here was a funny moment from the day. Like trying to focus on those small moments is how, I mean, that's why as many teachers have stuck with it as they have, is because they tell themselves it's for the kids, but like that can't be your only reason. You've gotta find other reasons too.
Good. I like it.
All right. You ready for the most important question
of the evening? Right. Hit me.
It wouldn't be a return to school special if we didn't talk about the most famous wizarding school in all of the world, Hogwarts. So the question for you, which Hogwarts house would you want to be in, and which one would you have been chosen for?
Well, I will say, if I taught older kids, I would definitely consider decorating my classroom in like a Hogwarts theme. but my students are at the age they're at, are just, some of them are just barely getting to where they can read it and understand it. A lot of them have seen the movies, so they do like it, but they don't fully comprehend it and understand it the way older kids do. So for me, I love the Hogwarts question. I even have a sticker on my car that says Hogwarts wasn't hiring, so I teach muggles instead. Like if that's where I could teach, I'd teach there. but I think, oh man, back when this was like a big deal, I always kind of went for Gryffindor because that was like the home team, you know, because that's what Harry, Ron, and Hermione were, was Gryffindor. So it was kind of like that was like the important home team, you know, and so it was like that was kind of always what I went for. But over the years, as I've kind of progressed in myself as a person, I feel like I probably would be Ravenclaw, just because I'm a little bit more on the knowledge side of things. Like I really love learning and understanding. And so I feel like I kind of get drawn to that a little bit more now than when I was first involved in Harry Potter.
I like it.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we've just about covered everything that we were going to talk about. So regular listeners will know that we try to end every episode with a mindfulness moment. And as I was typing up some of the notes on this, I was looking for some thoughts about education. And when I was a teenager, I went through a bit of a philosophy phase and read a lot of Socrates, Plato, some of the old Greek philosophers. And I found this quote by Socrates, written by Plato. And I thought it would be cool to talk about it. And it says, "Education is the kindling of a flame, not the filling of a vessel." And I wanted to pick both of your thoughts on this, having worked in education. What is the difference between kindling a flame and filling a vessel? And why is education the former of those two? So discuss.
I mean, I love this quote. I love the idea of thinking that education is the flame and we're trying to help grow it and keep it there. And I think that leads back to that you know, comments I made about curiosity and like not squashing a child's curiosity. And I think that to me is the difference, is the kindling of the flame is finding out what's already there and helping a child build it, helping them think for themselves. Whereas like the filling of a vessel is saying, okay, you are going to fit this mold and we're going to give you the information to fit in this specific vessel in this mold. Whereas a flame can go wherever it can get space. So to me, that's the difference between the two, is like recognizing that education really should be something that can helping them learn the skills they need to apply to anything.
Awesome. I guess it's my turn now. I have a slightly different take on it. And I'm going to take your quote and I'm going to counter it with another one that I learned when I was doing martial arts. And it's from Bruce Lee. And he says, empty your cup so that it may be filled. I'm not going to do the rest of it, because he talks about like the Zen of being an empty vessel in order to build up. But the whole empty your cup thing, or a vessel to be filled, the second part, what education is not. A vessel is a finite thing. You can only put so much water, only so much material into it before it overflows and everything's lost. Whereas a fire, if you add to it, it burns brighter and hotter. And so education should be, my take on this is education should be more about kindling an interest that will extend outside of the vessel that is the classroom. So like spawning, or like creating interest beyond what's taught, instead of just teaching to a test or just teaching to a subject. So that's my take on it.
Nice. I definitely went the same route that you did, Steve. but I really like the way that both of you frame that. And I think both answers are, you know, obviously correct. And they both speak to the importance of education, just kind of in general. So, yeah, I like it.
Well, the best teachers follow the Socratic method of teaching through question asking, right? So,
absolutely. We need more inquiry-based teaching.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for coming. It was great to have you and listen to your expertise. I'm really excited to see how the world responds to the expertise that is Chelsea. You can join us next week as we explore the deep, dark forests of the internet and search for the truth about what is the Sasquatch. We'll see you then.
Bye for now.